decent enough, albeit as stiff as an old Latin schoolmaster, how was he to make contact with Strang without being seen by Sauer? Every time he looked around, it seemed the SS man was watching him. He suspected he had also alerted some of his comrades. It would take him less than half a minute to saunter over to the British delegation's room. Unfortunately, he could only do so in full view of the entire assembly. What possible excuse could he contrive? His mind, tired from two nights of little sleep, circled endlessly around the problem without finding a solution. Nevertheless, he decided he would have to try. At 3 o'clock, he stood to stretch his legs. He walked around the corner, past the Führer's office, to the balustrade nearest the British delegation's room. He rested his hands on the cold marble, leaned casually against it, and looked down into the lobby. A group of men were standing together at the foot of the second staircase, talking quietly. He guessed they were the drivers. He risked a surreptitious glance at the British. Suddenly there was a noise behind him. The door to Hitler's study opened, and Chamberlain appeared. He looked much grimmer than he had a couple of hours earlier. After him came Wilson, then Daladier and Leger. Daladier, patting his pockets, pulled out a cigarette case. At once the British and French delegations streamed out from their respective rooms to meet them. As they hurried past him, Hartmann heard Chamberlain call out, "Come on, gentlemen, we're leaving." And the two groups walked along the gallery to the far staircase and began to descend. A minute later, Hitler and Mussolini emerged and stalked off in the same direction, with Ciano trailing behind. Hitler's expression was still one of irritation. He was gesticulating at the Duce, muttering to him angrily, his right hand making sweeping gestures as if he wished to consign the entire business to oblivion. The glorious possibility occurred to Hartmann that perhaps the whole thing had collapsed. Leggett was at his desk in the Regina Palazzo office, sorting through the contents of the red boxes and putting aside the documents annotated by the Prime Minister requiring urgent action, when he heard the crowd begin to cheer again. He got to his feet and looked down into Maximilianplatz. An open Mercedes had drawn up outside the hotel. Chamberlain was climbing out, accompanied by Wilson. Other cars were arriving behind it. The British delegation appeared on the pavement. Joan joined him at the window. "Were you expecting them back this early?" "No, there was nothing scheduled." He locked the boxes and went out into the corridor. At the far end, the lift bell rang softly. The doors opened, and the Prime Minister emerged with Wilson and one of his Scotland Yard detectives. "Good afternoon, Prime Minister." "Hello, Hugh." His voice was tired. In the weak electric light, he looked almost spectral. "Where are we based?" "Your suite is here, sir." As soon as he crossed the threshold, the Prime Minister disappeared into the bathroom. Wilson went over to the window and looked down at the crowd. He, too, seemed exhausted. "How did it go, sir?"
"It was pretty bloody. Will you tell the others to come in here? Everyone needs to be briefed."
Leggett stationed himself in the corridor and diverted the arriving delegates into the room. Within 2 minutes it was full. Strang, Malkin, Ashton, Gwatkin and Dunglass, together with Henderson and Kirkpatrick from Berlin. Leggett went in last. He closed the door behind him, just as the Prime Minister came out of his bedroom. He had changed his collar and washed his face. The hair behind his ears was still damp. He looked altogether brighter.
"Gentlemen, please sit down."
He took the large armchair facing the room and waited while they all found a seat.
"Horace, why don't you put everyone in the picture?"
"Thank you, Prime Minister.
Well, the whole thing was somewhat of a Mad Hatter's tea party, as you've probably gathered."
He pulled a small notebook from his inside pocket and opened it out.
"We started with a speech from Hitler, the gist of which was, A, that Czechoslovakia is now a threat to peace in Europe, B, that 250,000 refugees have fled the Sudetenland into Germany in the past few days, and C, that the whole situation is critical and must be settled by Saturday. Either Britain and France and Italy will have to guarantee that the Czechs will start evacuating the disputed territory on that day, or he'll march in and take it."
He kept looking at his watch as if he was checking when the 24-hour pause on mobilization would expire.
Overall, I must say my impression is that he's not bluffing, and we either sort this thing out today, or it's war.
He turned a page.
Then Mussolini produced a draft agreement in Italian, which the Germans have since had translated.
He fished around in his other inside pocket and pulled out a few typewritten pages. Translated into German, that is.
As far as we can gather, it's more or less what was proposed before.
He threw it onto the coffee table.
Strang said, "Will Hitler accept an international commission to determine which areas are to become German?" "No, he says there's no time for that. There should be a plebiscite, and each district can decide according to a simple majority."
"And what happens to the minority?"
"They will have to evacuate by October 10th. He also wants us to guarantee that the Czechs won't destroy any of their installations before they leave."
The Prime Minister said, "It's the word guarantee I don't like. How on earth can we guarantee anything unless we know the Czechs will agree?"
"Then surely they need to be at the conference."
"Exactly the point I made.
Unfortunately, this led to the usual vulgar tirade against the Czechs. There was a lot of this."
The Prime Minister smacked his fist into his open palm repeatedly. Wilson consulted his notes.
"To be exact, he said that he had agreed to postpone military action, but if those who had urged him to do so were not prepared to take responsibility for Czechoslovakia's compliance, he would have to reconsider."
"Good God!"
Chamberlain said, "Nevertheless, I stood my ground. It's inconceivable that we should guarantee Czech compliance unless the Czechs themselves agree."
Henderson said, "What was the French position on bringing the Czechs into the talks?"
"To begin with, Daladier backed me up, but then after about half an hour he changed his tune. What exactly was it he said, Horace?"
Wilson read from his notebook.
"If the inclusion of a Prague representative would cause difficulties, he was ready to forgo this, as it was important that the question should be settled speedily." To which I countered that I wasn't insisting that the Czechs should actually take part in the discussions, but at the very least they should be in the next room, so that they could give us the necessary assurances.
Wilson said, "You were very firm, Prime Minister."
"Well, yes, I was. I had to be. Daladier is utterly useless. He gives the impression he's loathing every minute of being here and just wants to sign an agreement and get home to Paris as quickly as possible. Once it became clear we weren't going to get anywhere, in fact, that there was a risk the whole thing might break up in acrimony, I proposed we adjourn for an hour so that we could consult with our respective delegations about Mussolini's draft."
"And the Czechs?"
"Let's wait and see. By the end, Hitler had a face like thunder. He's taken Mussolini and Himmler back to his apartment for lunch. I can't say I envy Musso that particular social engagement."
He broke off. He screwed up his face in disgust.
"What on earth is that?"
Through the closed windows came the thump of the band outside the hotel. Leggett said, "It's the Lambeth Walk, Prime Minister." In the Führerbau, the German and Italian officials had drifted back towards the room where the buffet lunch had been laid out. The two groups didn't mingle. The Germans felt themselves superior to the Italians. The Italians thought the Germans vulgar. Over by the window, a circle formed around Weizsäcker and Schmidt. Hartmann collected a plate of food and joined them. Weizsäcker was showing round a document, typed in German. He seemed very pleased with himself. It took a moment for Hartmann to grasp that this was some kind of draft agreement produced at the leaders' meeting by Mussolini. So the talks hadn't broken down after all. He felt his earlier good spirits evaporate. His dismay must have shown on his face, because Sauer said, "There's no need to look quite so miserable about it, Hartmann. At least we have the basis of an agreement."
"I'm not miserable, Herr Sturmbannführer, merely amazed that Dr. Schmidt could have managed to translate it so quickly."
Schmidt laughed and rolled his eyes at his naivety.
"My dear Hartmann, I didn't have to translate a thing. That draft was written last night in Berlin. Mussolini pretended it was his own work."
Weizsäcker said,
"Do you honestly think we would have left something so important to the Italians?"
The others joined in the laughter. Across the room, a couple of the Italians turned to look at them. Weizsäcker became serious. He put his finger to his lips. I think we should keep our voices down.
Leggett spent the next hour in the office, translating the text of the Italians' draft agreement from German into English. It wasn't very long, less than 1,000 words. As he finished each page, he gave it to Joan to type. At various points, the members of the British delegation trooped into the office to read over his shoulder. 1. The evacuation will begin on October 1st. 2. The United Kingdom, France, and Italy guarantee that the evacuation of the territory shall be completed by October 10th. And so it went on, 8 paragraphs in all. It was Malkin, the Foreign Office lawyer, sitting in an armchair in the corner, reading through the pages and puffing on his pipe, who suggested that guarantee should be replaced with agree, a clever stroke, seemingly trivial, that completely altered the tenor of the draft. Wilson took it along the corridor to show to the Prime Minister, who was resting in his room. The word came back that Chamberlain agreed. It was Malkin also who pointed out that the whole thrust of the document implied that 3 powers, Britain, France, and Italy, were making concessions to a 4th, Germany, a thrust which gave what he called an unfortunate impression. He therefore wrote out a preamble to the agreement in his Chancery Lane copperplate. Germany, the United Kingdom, France, and Italy, taking into consideration the agreement, which has been already reached in principle for the secession to Germany of the Sudeten German territory, have agreed on the following terms and conditions governing the said secession and the measures consequent thereon, and by this agreement they each hold themselves responsible for the steps necessary to secure its fulfilment. The Prime Minister signalled his agreement to that as well. He also asked for the folder containing the 1930 Czech census results that was in his red box. Joan retyped the document from the beginning. Just after 4 p.m. it was finished, and the delegation began moving downstairs to their cars. Chamberlain came out from his bedroom into the drawing room, looking tense, nervously smoothing his moustache with his thumb and forefinger. Leggett handed him the folder. Wilson muttered, "Perhaps a better quotation from Shakespeare to have used at Heston might have been, 'Once more unto the breach, dear friends.'" The corners of the Prime Minister's mouth turned down slightly. His detective said, "Are you ready to go, sir?" Chamberlain nodded and walked out of the room. As Wilson turned to follow him, Leggett decided to make one last appeal. "I really think I would be more useful at the actual conference, sir, rather than hanging around here. There's bound to be further translating to be done." "Oh, no, no, the Ambassador and Kirkpatrick can handle that. You man the fort here. Really, you're doing a splendid job." He patted Leggett's arm. "You need to get on to number 10 straight away and read them the text of our revised draft. Ask them to make sure it's circulated to the Foreign Office. Well, here goes." He hurried after the Prime Minister. Leggett returned to the office, picked up the telephone, and once again booked a call to London. This time, to his surprise, it went through. For Hartmann, the existence of a draft agreement changed everything. Clever minds would now bend themselves to smoothing over points of difference. Iron principles would shimmer and then magically vanish. The most contentious issues of all, on which no accord was possible, would simply be ignored entirely and left to subcommittees to deal with at a later date. He knew how these things worked. He edged away from the luncheon party, replaced his plate on the buffet table, and slipped out of the room. He reckoned he might only have an hour or two at best. He needed to find some secluded space. To his left were a couple of closed doors, and beyond them a gap in the wall. He walked towards it. The landing of a service staircase. He looked over his shoulder. No one seemed to have noticed his departure. He sidestepped quickly and began to descend. He passed a chef in kitchen whites climbing the stairs, carrying a tray of covered dishes. The man ignored him. He continued on down, past the ground floor, all the way to the basement. The passage was wide. The walls whitewashed, the floor smooth flagstones like the cellar of a castle. It appeared to run the entire length of the building. He could smell food cooking nearby, could hear the metallic crashes of a kitchen. He walked on firmly, in the manner of a man who had every right to be wherever he wished. There was a loud murmur of conversation ahead, a clattering of plates and cutlery. He came out into a large cafeteria where several dozen SS guards were having lunch. The air was thick with cigarette smoke and the smell of beer. A few faces turned to look at him. He nodded. Beyond the cafeteria, the passage resumed. He passed a staircase, a guard room, opened a large metal door and stepped into the heat of the afternoon. It was the car park at the back of the building. A dozen black Mercedes were drawn up in a line. A couple of drivers were smoking. Faintly in the distance he heard cheers and shouts of Sieg Heil. He turned around quickly and went back inside. An SS man appeared from the guard room.
What are you doing? Hurry up, man. Can't you hear the Führer is returning?
He pushed past him and started climbing the staircase. He trotted up the steps quickly. His heart felt too full for his chest. He was sweating. He passed the ground floor and ascended the next two flights and emerged more or less exactly where he had been standing when the first session of the conference broke up. There was a flurry of activity. Aides were moving hastily into position, straightening their jackets, smoothing down their hair, looking along the corridor. Hitler and Mussolini came into view, walking side by side. Behind them came Himmler and Ciano. It was clear that the luncheon interval had done nothing to improve Hitler's mood. Mussolini stopped to talk to Attolico, but Hitler stamped on regardless, followed by the German delegation. At the entrance to his study he halted and turned to look down the length of the building. Hartmann, no more than 10 paces away, saw the irritation in his face. He began to rock up and down on the balls of his feet, that same strange, unconscious mannerism Hartmann had witnessed on the train. From outside came more applause. Then shortly afterwards Chamberlain appeared at the top of the far staircase, followed by Daladier. They, too, began to confer, standing alone beside a pillar. Hitler watched them for perhaps a minute. Suddenly he wheeled round, located Ribbentrop, and gestured angrily at him to go and fetch them. He disappeared into his study, and Hartmann felt a rush of renewed optimism. The professional diplomats might imagine the deal was already done, but nothing could be settled until Hitler willed it. And he still looked as if he would like nothing more than to send them all packing. Chapter 7 It must have been after 5 when Leggett finished dictating the final clause to the stenographer in Downing Street. The Czechoslovak government will, within a period of 4 weeks from the date of this agreement, release from their military and police forces any Sudeten Germans who may wish to be released, and the Czechoslovak government will, within the same period, release Sudeten German prisoners who are serving terms of imprisonment for political offence. Have you got all that?
Yes, sir.
He tucked the receiver under his chin and began gathering together the pages of the draft. In the distance he heard raised voices. The door had been left half open. There was some kind of argument going on in the corridor.
Engländer!
A man was shouting in a thick accent.
Ich verlange mit einem Engländer zu sprechen!
Leggett exchanged puzzled glances with the two secretaries. He beckoned to Joan to take the telephone, put his hand over the receiver and said to her,
Get them to keep the line open.
She nodded and took his place at the desk. He went out into the corridor. At the far end of the passage, near the back of the hotel, a figure was gesticulating, trying to push his way past a group of 4 men in suits. They kept moving to block his path.
Englishman! I demand to speak to an Englishman!
Leggett walked towards them.
I am English. Can I help?
The man called out,
Thank God! I am Dr. Hubert Massari, chef de cabinet of the Foreign Minister of Czechoslovakia. These men are from the Gestapo, and they are holding me and my colleague, the Czech minister in Berlin, Dr. Wojciech Masny, imprisoned in this room.
He was about 40, distinguished-looking in a pale grey suit with a handkerchief in his breast pocket. His long, high-domed head was flushed. At some point his round tortoiseshell spectacles had been knocked awry. Leggett said, May I ask who is in charge here? One of the Gestapo men swung round. He was broad-faced, with a hard, tight mouth and badly pockmarked cheeks, as if he had suffered smallpox in his youth. He looked ready for a fight.
And who are you?
My name is Hugh Leggett. I am the private secretary to Prime Minister Chamberlain.
The Gestapo officer's attitude changed at once. There is no question of imprisonment, Herr Legate. We have merely asked these gentlemen to wait in their room for their own security while the conference is in progress. But we are supposed to be observers of this conference. Mussari adjusted his spectacles. I appeal to the representative of the British government to allow us to do what we were sent here to do. May I? Legate gestured to be allowed to pass. The three other Gestapo men looked to the officer. He nodded. They stood aside. Legate shook hands with Mussari. I'm very sorry about this. Where is your colleague? He followed Mussari into the bedroom. A professional figure in his 60s, still wearing his overcoat, was seated on the edge of the bed, holding his hat between his knees. He stood as Legate entered. He looked utterly dejected. Musni. He held out his hand. Mussari said, "We landed from Prague less than an hour ago and were met by these people at the airport. We assumed we were being taken directly to the conference. Instead, we have been forced to remain here. It is an outrage." The Gestapo man was standing in the doorway. "As I have explained, they are not allowed to participate in the conference. My orders are that they are to wait in their hotel room until further instructions have been issued. Therefore, we are under arrest. Not at all. You are free to return to the airport and fly back to Prague whenever you wish." Legate said, "May I ask who issued this order?" The Gestapo officer stuck out his chest. "I believe it comes from the Führer himself." "An outrage!" Mastny put his hand on his colleague's arm. "Calm yourself, Hubert. I am more used to life in Germany than you are. There is no point in shouting." He turned to Legate. "You are the private secretary to Mr. Chamberlain? Perhaps you might speak to the Prime Minister on our behalf and see if this unfortunate situation can be resolved?" Legate looked at the two Czechs, and then at the Gestapo man who was standing with his arms folded. "Let me go and see what I can do." The crowd in the park opposite the hotel was still large. They watched him leave without interest, an official in a suit, a nobody. He walked quickly, head down. Max-Josef-Strasse was quiet and lined with cherry trees, flanked in turn by handsome apartment blocks of red and white stone. There was a smoky mellowness in the air. Pushing through the autumn drifts in the warm, late afternoon light reminded him of Oxford. Two well-dressed elderly women exercised their dogs. A uniformed nanny pushed a pram. It was only after he had been walking for about 5 minutes, after he had passed the obelisk in the centre of the roundabout and gone a little way towards Königsplatz, that he sensed that at some point he had crossed an invisible frontier into a darker and less familiar world. What he remembered as a park had become a parade ground. In a pagan temple, a black-uniformed soldier stood guard before an eternal flame. He could tell the Führerbau by the crowd on the granite square in front of it. The building itself was monumental, impersonal, of whitish stone, 3 stories, with a balcony in the middle of the first floor where he could imagine Hitler appearing at one of those vast, quasi-religious spectacles that filled the newsreels. He walked past the hanging flags and the bronze eagles to the edge of the second red carpet. He explained his official status to a sentry and was allowed to pass. An officer in an SS uniform just inside the lobby checked his name on a list. "Where would I find the British delegation?" "On the first floor, Herr Legate, in the reception room in the far corner." The adjutant clicked his heels. Legate climbed the wide red marble staircase and turned right. He passed an area of low tables and armchairs, and suddenly, there ahead of him was Hartmann. It took him a few seconds to be sure it was actually him. He was standing, holding a cup and saucer, talking to a silver-haired man in a dark blue suit. His hair had been receding when he was at Oxford, but now he was almost entirely bald. His handsome head was cocked, listening to his companion. He looked stooped, strained, weary. Yet, for all that, something of the old aura still hung around him, even at a distance. He spotted Legate over the other man's shoulder, registered him with a slight widening of his violet eyes, and gave a barely perceptible shake of his head. Legate walked on. Through the open door he could see Strang and Dunglass. The British party looked up as he walked in. They had spread themselves around the large room. Henderson was reading a German newspaper. Kirkpatrick had his legs stretched out and his eyes closed. Malkin had some papers on his lap. Ashton Gwatkin appeared to be reading a volume of Japanese poetry. Strang said sharply, You? What are you doing here? I thought you were supposed to stay at the hotel.
I was, sir, but something's come up. The Czech delegation have arrived at the Regina Palast, and they're being prevented from leaving their room.
Prevented? How?
By the Gestapo. They want the Prime Minister to intercede on their behalf. There were groans from all round the room.
The Gestapo?
Ashton Watkin muttered, beasts. Henderson said, I don't see why they should imagine the PM can do anything about that.
Even so, it will be hard to make an agreement without them.
Strang sucked on the stem of his unlit pipe. It cracked and whistled.
I think you'd better go and soothe them, Frank. You know them better than the rest of us.
Ashton Watkin sighed and closed his book. Leggett noticed that Dunglass was stretching his neck to peer along the corridor in the manner of one of those mystified-looking birds he liked to shoot. Kirkpatrick saw it too.
What is it, Alec? Is something happening?
Yes, said Dunglass. As usual, he drawled without seeming to move his lips. Hitler's door is open.
Hartmann thought that the passage of 6 years had barely changed Leggett at all. He might have been crossing the quad at Balliol. There was the same odd combination of age and youth, the thick, dark, boyish hair flicked back off his forehead, and the pale gravity of his expression, the lightness of his movements. He had been a runner at Oxford, encased in those stiff, old-fashioned clothes. The sight of him caused Hartmann briefly to lose track of what von Weizsäcker was saying. He failed to notice Schmidt hurrying towards them.
Herr von Weizsäcker and Signor Attolico.
Schmidt nodded to the State Secretary and beckoned to the Italian ambassador.
Excuse me, gentlemen. The Führer would like you to join the talks.
The men sitting nearest them overheard. Heads turned. Weizsäcker nodded as if he had been expecting this.
Does he want anyone else?
Only the British and French ambassadors.
I'll fetch them,
volunteered Hartmann. Without waiting for a reply, he set off towards the two delegations. He entered the French room first.
Monsieur François Poncet?
The boulevardier's face, with its old-fashioned wax moustache, swung round to look at him.
Forgive me, Your Excellency. The leaders would like their ambassadors to join them.
Even before François Poncet was on his feet, Hartmann was striding next door.
Sir Neville, a request from the Führer's study. Would you please be good enough to join the heads of government?
Strang said,
Only Sir Neville.
Only Sir Neville.
At last. Henderson folded his newspaper and placed it on the table. He stood and checked his buttonhole in the mirror.
Kirkpatrick said, Good luck.
Thanks. He sauntered out of the room.
Does this mean there's been a breakthrough?
I fear I'm only the messenger, Mr. Strang.
Hartmann smiled and bowed slightly. He glanced around.
Are you comfortable in here? Is there anything you need?
We're fine, thank you, Herr...
Strang paused.
Hartmann.
Herr Hartmann, of course, excuse me.
Hartmann waited, and Strang found himself obliged to introduce his colleagues.
This is Lord Dunglass, the Prime Minister's Parliamentary Private Secretary, and Sir William Malcolm of the Foreign Office, Frank Ashton Watkin, also of the Foreign Office, Yvonne Kirkpatrick from the Berlin Embassy, I expect you know.
Indeed, Mr. Kirkpatrick, very good to see you again.
Hartmann went round the room, shaking hands.
And this is Hugh Leggett, one of the Prime Minister's private secretaries.
Mr. Leggett.
Herr Hartmann.
Hartmann held on to Leggett's hand a fraction longer than he had the others, and tugged it gently.
Well, do let me know if I can be of any assistance.
Leggett said, I should get back to the hotel.
And I suppose I should talk to the poor old Czechs,
said Ashton Watkin wearily,
assuming I can find a telephone that works.
The three men went out into the corridor and walked towards Hitler's study. The door had already closed again.
Hartmann said, Let us hope some progress is being made.
He stopped.
I shall look forward to seeing you later. If you'll excuse me, gentlemen.
He inclined his head graciously, turned to his left, and began to descend the service stairs. Leggett continued on his way with Ashton Watkin for a few more paces. Then he too halted.
I'm sorry, I just remember there's something I need to tell Strang.
The ploy seemed so obvious it embarrassed him, but Ashton Watkin merely raised his hand in farewell.
Later, dear boy,
and carried on walking. Leggett retraced his steps. Without a backward glance, he followed Hartmann down the stairs. He couldn't see him.
but he could hear the soles of his shoes ringing on the steps. He expected him to stop at the ground floor. Instead, the clatter of leather on stone continued for another two flights, until Leggett found himself emerging onto a basement passage, just in time to catch a gleam of daylight to his right, and the noise of a door slamming shut. He preferred not to think of the absurdity of the figure he must cut, the Whitehall civil servant in his dark suit and watch chain hurrying along the subterranean service corridor of the Führer's private palace. If Cleverly could see him, he would have a heart attack. I trust I don't need to emphasize the absolute necessity that you do nothing whatsoever that might imperil the success of this conference. He passed a guard room, empty, he was relieved to see, opened the heavy steel door and stepped out into daylight and a courtyard full of black Mercedes. At the far end, Hartman was waiting. He waved and hurried towards him, but Hartman immediately set off again, turning right and vanishing from view. From then on, he kept consistently about 100 yards ahead. He led Leggett past the two temples of honour with their motionless guards and wavering flames, past another monumental white stone Nazi building identical to the Führerbau, then out of Königsplatz altogether, and into a wide street with big office blocks festooned with swastikas. Leggett read their nameplates as he passed, the office of the Deputy Führer, the Reich Central Office for the implementation of the 4-year plan. He glanced over his shoulder. Nobody seemed to be following him. Ahead was an ugly modern building that looked like the entrance to a railway station, but advertised itself as Park Café. Hartman went inside. A minute later, Leggett did the same. It was the end of the working day. The bar was crowded, mostly with workers from the nearby government offices, to judge by the look of them. There were a lot of brown party uniforms. He peered around for Hartman through the clouds of cigarette smoke and saw his bald head in the corner. He was sitting at a table with his back to the room, but facing a mirror so that he could watch what was happening. Leggett slipped into the seat opposite him. Hartman's wide mouth split into the familiar vulpine grin.
"Well," he said, "here we are again, my friend."
And Leggett remembered that for Paul there was always amusement to be had in any situation, even this one. Then Hartman added more seriously, "Were you followed?"
"I don't know. I don't think so. I'm not exactly used to this sort of thing."
"Welcome to the new Germany, my dear Hugh. You'll find one has to get used to it." The man at the next table was in an SA uniform. He was reading Der Stürmer, a vile caricature of a Jew with the tentacles of an octopus dominated the front page. Leggett hoped the noise from the bar was too loud for them to be overheard. He said quietly, "Is it safe here?"
"No, but safer than staying where we were. We will order 2 beers. We will pay for them and take them out into the garden. We will continue to speak entirely in German. We are 2 old friends, meeting after a long interval, with a great deal to catch up on. This much is true. Lies are always best when mostly true." He signalled to the waiter,
2 beers, please."
"You haven't changed much."
"Ah!" Hartman laughed. "If only you knew." He pulled out a lighter and a pack of cigarettes, offered one, leaned over and lit Leggett's first and then his own. They sat back and smoked in silence for a while. Occasionally Hartman looked at him and shook his head as if he couldn't believe it. Leggett said, "Won't they be wondering where you are?"
"One or two will no doubt be looking for me."
He shrugged. "It can't be helped." Leggett looked around the bar. The unfamiliar tobacco was strong. It burned the back of his throat. He felt horribly exposed.
"Let's hope they don't finish the talks before we get back."
"I don't think that's likely, do you? Even if there's an agreement, there's sure to be some while yet, settling all the details. And if there isn't, then it's war." Hartman flourished his cigarette. "And then you and I and our little meeting will be entirely irrelevant." He regarded Leggett through the smoke. His large eyes were more hooded than Leggett remembered.
"I read that you had married."
"Yes.
And you?"
"No."
"What happened to Lena?"
He had promised himself he wouldn't ask. Hartman's gaze flicked away. His mood changed. "I'm afraid we no longer speak." The waiter arrived with their beers. He set them down and moved off to serve another customer. Leggett realized he had no German money. Hartman put a handful of coins on the table. Have this on me.
My round, as we used to say. He closed his eyes briefly. The cock and camel. The crown and thistle. The pheasant and St. Giles. How are they all? How is everyone? How is Isaiah?
It's all still there. Oxford is still there.
Not for me, alas.
He looked maudlin.
Well, I suppose we should transact our business.
The brown shirt at the next table had paid his bill and was rising to go, leaving his newspaper on the table. Hartman said,
"Excuse me, comrade, but if you've finished with your Stürmer, might I take it?"
"My pleasure."
The man handed it over, nodded to them affably, and left.
"You see," said Hartman, "they're quite charming when you get to know them. Bring your beer, we'll go outside."
He stubbed out his cigarette. There were metal tables on a gravel surface beneath bare trees. The sun had gone. It would soon be dusk. The beer garden was as busy as the bar, men in lederhosen, women in dirndls. Hartman led him over to a small table beside a bed of lavender. Beyond it was a botanical park. The neat paths and flower beds, the specimens of trees, seemed familiar. Leggett said,
"Haven't we been here before?"
"Yes. We sat over there and had an argument. You accused me of being a Nazi at heart."
"Did I? I'm sorry.
Sometimes to an outsider, German nationalism didn't sound that much different to Nazism."
Hartman flicked his hand.
"Let's not get into all that. There isn't time."
He pulled out a chair. The steel legs scraped on the gravel. They sat. Leggett refused another cigarette. Hartman lit one for himself.
"So, let me get straight to the point of it. I would like you to arrange for me to meet with Chamberlain."
Leggett sighed.
"They told me in London that was what you wanted. I'm sorry, Powell, it's just not possible. But you are his secretary. Secretaries arrange meetings. I'm the most junior of his secretaries. I fetch and carry. He'd no more listen to me than he would to that waiter over there. And besides, isn't it rather too late for meetings?"
Hartman shook his head.
"Right now, at this very moment, it is not too late. It will only be too late after your Prime Minister has signed this agreement."
Leggett cupped the beer glass in his hands and bowed his head. He remembered this absurd stubbornness, this refusal to abandon a chain of reasoning even when demonstrably it had started from a false premise. They might have been arguing in the tap room of the Eagle and Child.
"Powell, I promise you there's nothing you can say to him that he hasn't considered already. If you're going to warn him that Hitler's a bad man, save your breath, he knows it."
"Then why is he making this deal with him?"
"For all the reasons of which you're aware. Because on this issue, Germany has a strong case, and the fact that it's being put by Hitler doesn't make it any weaker."
He remembered now why he had accused Hartman of being a Nazi. His main objection to Hitler always seemed to be snobbish, that he was a vulgar Austrian corporal rather than ideological.
"I must say you've changed your tune. Weren't you always going on about the injustices of the Versailles Treaty? Appeasement is simply an attempt to redress those same wrongs."
"Yes, and I stand by every word."
Hartman leaned across the table and continued in an urgent whisper,
"And there's part of me, yes, my dear Hugh, I admit it, that rejoices that you and the French have finally had to come crawling on your hands and knees to put it right. The trouble is, you've left it too late. Overturning Versailles, that's nothing to Hitler any more. That's just the prelude for what is to come."
"And this is what you want to tell the Prime Minister?"
"Yes, and not just tell him. I want to show him proof. I have it here."
He patted his chest.
"You look amused."
"No, not amused. I just think you're naive. If only things were that simple."
"They are simple. If Chamberlain refuses tonight to continue to negotiate under duress, then Hitler will invade Czechoslovakia tomorrow. And the moment he issues that order, everything will change, and we, in the opposition, in the army and elsewhere, will take care of Hitler."
Leggett folded his arms and shook his head.
"It is at this point that I'm afraid you lose me. You want my country to go to war to prevent 3 million Germans joining Germany, on the off chance that you and your friends can then get rid of Hitler. Well, I have to say, from what I've seen today, he looks pretty well entrenched to me." He stopped himself from going on, although there was plenty more he could have said. He could have asked whether it was true that Hartmann and his friends, as their emissaries in London had made clear over the summer, intended to hang on to Austria and to the Sudetenland, even if Hitler was deposed, and if it was also true that their aim was to restore the Kaiser, in which case what should he whisper to his father the next time he visited him, lying in an ocean of white stone crosses in a war cemetery in Flanders? He felt a spasm of irritation. Let's just sign the bloody agreement, get back on the plane, fly out of here, and leave them to get on with it. The electric lamps were coming on, strings of pretty yellow lanterns suspended between ornate wrought-iron poles. They glowed in the gathering dusk. Hartmann said, "So you will not help me? If you're asking me to arrange a private meeting with the Prime Minister, then I have to say no. It is impossible. On the other hand, if there's some proof of Hitler's ambitions that we ought to be aware of, then yes, if you give it to me now, I'll undertake to make sure he sees it, before he signs any agreement in Munich." Leggett hesitated. "If there's an opportunity, yes. Will you give me your word that you'll try?" "Yes." Hartmann stared at Leggett for several seconds. Finally, he picked up Der Stürmer from the table. It was a tabloid, easy to hold in one hand. He shielded himself with it. With the other hand, he began unfastening the buttons of his shirt. Leggett twisted on the hard metal chair and looked around the beer garden. Everyone seemed preoccupied with their own amusement. But in the undergrowth around them, any number of eyes could be watching. Hartmann folded the paper and slid it back across the table to Leggett. He said, "I should go now. You should stay and finish your beer. It would be best from now on if we did not acknowledge one another." "I understand." Hartmann stood. It was suddenly important to Leggett that things were not left like this. He stood as well. "I do appreciate, we all appreciate, the risks that you and your colleagues are taking. If things become dangerous, and you need to leave Germany, I can promise you that you will be well looked after. I am not a traitor. I will never leave Germany." "I know. But the offer is there." They shook hands. "Finish your drink, Hugh." Hartmann turned and walked across the gravel towards the cafe, his tall figure moving awkwardly between the tables and chairs. There was a brief glow from the interior as he opened the door. Then the door closed, and he was gone. Chapter 8 Leggett sat motionless, watching the moths dancing around the garden lights. The smell of lavender was strong in the warm night air. After a while, cautiously, with the tip of his thumb and forefinger, he opened the newspaper. Inside, next to a story about Aryan maidens being raped by Jews, lay a plain manila envelope. Judging by its weight, it contained about 24 sheets of paper. He refolded Der Stürmer, waited another 5 minutes, then rose to his feet. He wove between the tables of beer drinkers, through the smoky bar, out of the door on its opposite side, and into the street. In the big office blocks of the Deputy Führer and the 4-year plan, the windows gleamed. He had an impression of activity, of urgent, purposeful preparation. He pressed on towards Königsplatz. As he approached the building that housed the administration of the Nazi Party, a group of uniformed officials came out onto the pavement. After he had skirted them, he heard one of them say, "Das kann nur ein Engländer sein." "That can only be an Englishman." There was laughter. On the granite parade ground, a pair of swastika banners, 6 stories high, were lit by spotlights. He could see the Führerbau directly ahead. He wondered if he should return to the conference. Given what he was carrying, it was surely too risky. He turned right between the temples of honour. A few minutes later, he was pushing through the revolving doors into the Regina Palast. In the lobby, a string quartet played Tales from the Vienna Woods. On the first-floor corridor, he ran into Ashton Gwatkin. He stopped beneath one of the dim candelabra.
"Hello, Hugh. What have you been up to?"
"Just running errands."
"I know. Isn't it awful? Nothing works. The phones are hopeless."
The walrus's heavy features were more than usually lugubrious.
I've just been with the Chekos.
How are they taking it?
As one would expect. They think the whole business stinks. I'm sure we would, too, in their place. But what can one do? The situation isn't improved by the fact the Germans still won't let them leave their room.
Are you heading back to the conference?
Apparently I'm wanted. I have a car downstairs.
He moved on, stopped, turned.
Incidentally, that fellow Hartman we met earlier, wasn't he a Rhodes Scholar at our college?
Leggett saw no point in denying it. That's right, yes.
I thought the name was familiar. What year did they start it up again after the war? 28?
29.
So he must have been there in your day. Surely you knew him.
I did.
But you pretended not to.
Obviously he doesn't want to shout about it, so I thought it wiser not to let on. The walrus thought about it, then nodded.
Quite right. The whole place is absolutely crawling with Gestapo.
He continued onwards in his stately fashion. Leggett went into the corner office. Joan and Miss Anderson were sitting at the table playing cards. He said, "Have London been on?" Joan played a card. "Quite often, actually." "What did you tell them?" "That you were away from the office having to deal with the checks."
"You're an angel."
"I know. What on earth are you reading?"
Sorry.
He transferred the newspaper to his other hand. "It's some ghastly anti-Jew rag. I'm looking for a place to chuck it." "Give it to me. I'll get rid of it for you."
"It's all right, thanks."
"Don't be silly. Let me take it." She held out her hand.
"Actually, I wouldn't want you to see it."
He could feel himself turning red. What a hopeless spy he was. She was looking at him as if he was very odd. He went back out into the corridor. At the far end of the passage, the two Gestapo men had found a pair of chairs and were sitting outside the Czech delegation's room. He turned left, searched his pockets for his key, and opened the door to his own room. It was in darkness. Through the large window he could see lights in the rooms on the opposite side of the courtyard. Inside, several people were moving around. In one, a man seemed to be staring directly at him. He drew the curtains and turned on the bedside lamp. His suitcase had been brought up by a porter and placed on the small table. He threw the newspaper onto the bed, went into the bathroom, ran the cold tap, and splashed his face. He felt shaky. He couldn't get the image of Hartman out of his mind, especially as he had looked at the end. His eyes had seemed to stare out at him from across some vast gulf that had widened the longer they talked. He dried himself and returned to the bedroom. He locked the door. He took off his jacket and draped it over the back of the chair, picked up the newspaper, sat at the desk and turned on the green-shaded reading lamp. Finally, he opened the envelope and pulled out the pages. The document was typed in the same large letters as the one he had received in London. The German was a hybrid of the Hitlerian and the bureaucratic, not easy to translate at first, but after a while he started to get the hang of it. Top Secret. Memorandum. Berlin, November 10, 1937. Minutes of a conference in the Reich Chancellery, Berlin, November 5, 1937, from 4:15 to 8:30 p.m. Present. The Führer and Chancellor. Field Marshal von Blomberg, War Minister. Colonel General Baron von Fritsch, Commander-in-Chief, Army. Admiral Dr. H. E. Reider, Commander-in-Chief, Navy. Colonel General Göring, Commander-in-Chief, Luftwaffe. Baron von Neurath, Foreign Minister. Colonel Hosbach, Military Adjutant to the Führer. The Führer began by stating that the subject of the present conference was of such importance that its discussion would, in other countries, certainly be a matter for a full cabinet meeting, but he, the Führer, had rejected the idea of making it a subject of discussion before the wider circle of the Reich cabinet, precisely because of the importance of the matter. His exposition to follow was the fruit of thorough deliberation and the experience of his 4.5 years of power. He wished to explain to the gentlemen present his basic ideas concerning the opportunities for the development of our position in the field of foreign affairs and its requirements, and he asked, in the interests of a long-term German policy, that his exposition be regarded, in the event of his death, as his last will and testament.
The Führer then continued. The aim of German policy was to make secure and to preserve the racial community and to enlarge it. It was therefore a question of space. The German racial community comprised over 85 million people, and because of their number and the narrow limits of habitable space in Europe, constituted a tightly packed racial core such as was not to be met in any other country and such as implied the right to a greater living space than in the case of other peoples. He stopped. Beside him on the bedside table, the telephone was ringing. At the Führerbau, things were finally beginning to happen. The door to Hitler's study was now permanently open. Hartmann watched Ashton Gwatkin come out, followed by Markin. François Poncet and Atolico went in to replace them. In the gallery, around the low tables, in the pools of light from the standard lamps, armchairs had been pulled together. Officials were bent over papers. He saw Erich Kord in the centre of one group. He must have travelled down from Berlin during the afternoon. The exception to all this activity was Daladier. He seemed to have withdrawn from proceedings entirely, and was sitting alone in a corner, smoking a cigarette. On the table in front of him was a bottle of beer and a glass. The only person Hartmann couldn't see was Sauer. Where was he? He found his absence ominous. He circled the first floor, trying to spot him. In the large room next to the French delegation's quarters, the armchairs and sofas had been pushed against the walls, and a makeshift office had been set up, with typewriters and extra telephones. Next to that was the banqueting hall. Through the open door he saw a long, white-clothed table with places laid for 60. Waiters hurried in and out with plates and bottles. A florist was arranging an elaborate centrepiece. Clearly a feast was in the offing. A celebration, presumably, which meant they must be close to an agreement, and he was nearly out of time. All his hopes now rested on Leggett. But what realistic hope was there? None, he thought bitterly. As he completed his circuit and returned to the gallery, Kort called out to him, "Hartmann, good evening." He rose. He was holding a sheaf of papers. "I have need of your skills. Would you mind?" He gestured with his head to an empty table in a quiet corner. As they sat, he said in a low voice, "Well, what's happened? Did you make contact with your friend?"
"Yes."
"And?"
"He has promised to speak to Chamberlain."
"Well, he'd better be quick about it. We're almost there."
"I thought the conference was scheduled to last at least another day."
"It was. But I would say that in the person of Neville Chamberlain, the Führer has finally met a negotiator even more obdurate than himself. The old gentleman has lured him into a morass of detail, and he simply can't stand it any longer. All unresolved issues are therefore to be settled after the conference by an international commission of the four powers. In this way, each side can claim victory." Hartmann swore and bowed his head. Kord patted his knee. "Cheer up, my dear fellow. I feel as sick about it as you do, but we will regroup, and one day we will try again. In the meantime, I advise you to look a little less funereal. The Führer's genius is about to bring 3 million of our fellow countrymen into the Reich without the firing of a shot. Your long face is inappropriate and will not go unnoticed. Now," he said, raising his voice and becoming businesslike, "I have documents that need to be translated from English into German." He searched through his bundle of documents and pulled out several pages. "Annexes and supplementary declarations relating to minorities and the composition of the International Commission. It seems our British friends are the only nation more keen on paperwork than our own." Leggett picked up the telephone cautiously.
"Hello? Hugh?"
"Yes."
"It's Alec Dunglass."
"Alec," Leggett was relieved. "What's going on?"
"It rather looks as though we have a deal."
"Good Lord, that was quick.
Hitler's invited us all to some ghastly Teutonic banquet while the documents are prepared for signature, but the PM thinks it will convey the wrong impression. Can you organize dinner for us at the hotel? We should be away from here by 9.
"Of course. Thanks so much." Dunglass hung up. A deal? Leggett had thought the talks would grind on for at least another day. He took out his watch. It was just after 8:20.
He went back to the desk, propped his head between his hands, and resumed reading, but much more quickly now, turning each page as soon as he had the gist of it. The Führer's case was densely argued. It began with his analysis of Germany's increasing need for food, acknowledged the unsustainability of its economy at the present pace of rearmament, and warned of the Third Reich's vulnerability to international trade sanctions and disruption of supply. The only remedy, and one which might appear to us as visionary, lay in the acquisition of greater living space. The space necessary to ensure it can only be sought in Europe. It is not a matter of acquiring population, but of gaining space for agricultural use. Germany's problem could only be solved by means of force. If the Führer was still living, it was his unalterable resolve to solve Germany's problem of space at the latest by 1943 to 1945. Leggett flicked back to the first page. November 5, 1937, less than 11 months ago. The incorporation of Austria and Czechoslovakia within Germany would provide, from the politico-military point of view, a substantial advantage, because it would mean shorter and better frontiers, the freeing of forces for other purposes, and the possibility of creating new units up to a level of about 12 divisions, that is, one new division per million inhabitants. The second part of the memorandum recorded the ensuing discussion. It was clear, reading between the lines, that the two senior military commanders, Blomberg and Fritsch, and the foreign minister, Neurath, had all expressed alarm about the practicability of Hitler's strategy. The French army was too strong, the Czech border defences were too formidable, Germany's motorised divisions were too weak. All three, Leggett realised, had since been removed from their positions, and had been replaced by Keitel, Brauchitsch, and Ribbentrop. He pushed back his chair. Hartmann was right. The Prime Minister absolutely ought to be aware of this before he signed any agreement. He stuffed the memorandum back into its envelope. In the corner office, he said to Joan, "Would you do me a favour? The PM and the others will be on their way back in about half an hour. Could you see if the hotel could rustle up some supper for everyone?" "All right, I'll see what I can do. Anything else?" "Yes. Could you get a message to Sir Alexander Cadogan at the Foreign Office? Just tell him I have it."
"You have what?"
"No need to say any more. He'll understand."
"Where are you off to now?"
Leggett was unlocking one of the red dispatch boxes. "I'm going to head back to the conference for a minute. There's a document I think the PM ought to see."
He half walked, half ran along the corridor. He didn't wait for the lift, but instead trotted down the stairs, marched across the lobby, and plunged into the Munich evening.
Hartmann was translating the supplementary declaration from English into German. "All questions which may arise out of the transfer of the territory shall be considered as coming within the terms of reference of the International Commission," when he glanced up and saw Leggett striding purposefully towards the room where the British delegation was based. He was carrying a small red case. The room was empty, apart from Dunglass. He stared at Leggett in surprise.
"I thought I told you we were coming back to the hotel."
"Something's come up. I need to have a quick word with the PM."
"Well, you can try, but he's still with the other leaders."
"Where is he?" Dunglass raised his eyebrows slightly, the closest he came to expressing strong emotion, and pointed to the door at the end of the corridor. It looked like the entrance to a hive, men hovering around it, going in and coming out. "Thanks." Leggett set off. No one tried to stop him. The four heads of government here present agree that the International Commission, provided for in the agreement signed by them today, shall consist of the Secretary of State in the German Foreign Office, the British, French, and Italian ambassadors accredited to Berlin, and a representative to be nominated by the government of Czechoslovakia. Even as his pen moved across the paper, Hartmann's eyes were following Leggett as he entered Hitler's study. The room was large, perhaps 50 feet long, crowded, stuffy. The tall windows were all closed. There was a faint, sour odour of male sweat. The Prime Minister was on the sofa in front of the fireplace, talking to Mussolini.
Leggett could see Wilson in the corner by the window with Sir Neville Henderson. At the far end, beside a giant globe, with his arms folded, leaning against the edge of a desk, listening to Ribbentrop and wearing an expression of utter boredom, he could see Hitler. After their first meeting, Chamberlain had described him to the cabinet as the commonest little dog you ever saw. The cabinet.